Hi there, and thank you for listening to Victory Laps, part of the Throwback Thursday celebrations for the 50th anniversary of Riverside International Speedway. I'm Dylan Langell, and thanks for checking us out at riversidespeedway.ca or listening on iTunes. If you missed our last episode, I got to chat with Greg Stewart and Junior Hanley. You can find that episode in the archives. Well, it's been over 2 months since we heard the engines roar at Riverside, but the excitement is already building for the IWK 250. July 18th, 2020 is the big day. I'll have more details a little later about Christmas packages, but before I chat with our guest on today's episode and let you know about the ticket details, I want to take this time to congratulate Jim Hallahan on receiving the inaugural Hellcat Award. Now, this award was presented at the banquet night for the Maritime Pro Stock Tour a few weeks ago in memory of our friend Alan Curry. It honors its recipient for outstanding off-track contributions to the Pro Stock Tour, its drivers, and the fans. Jim has done so much for racers and fans over the years, and we can't thank him enough for everything he has done, and we can't wait to see him again at Riverside in 2020. I actually got to chat with Jim back in June. You can hear our conversation online at riversidespeedway.ca. Also, congratulations to IWK 250 competitor Matt Crafton. He won his third NASCAR Truck Series Championship recently. Now let's dive into our show. Today, my guests are both Maritime Pro Stock Tour drivers, and they're going to share their stories at Riverside. It's very unique because both of these drivers have raced at Riverside before and after the renovations in 2006. My first guest has conquered the IWK 250 twice, and that driver is Kent Vincent. He's the driver of the number 8 Vincent Lamb Garnier car in the Maritime Pro Stock Tour. He's a two-time IWK 250 winner. It's Prince Edward Island's own Kent Vincent on Victory Laps. Kent, how are you this evening?
Very good. Very good, Dylan. Nice to talk to you.
Yeah, nice to chat with you. And I got to say, Kent, you have one of the coolest websites ever. When I was looking up information about you, wasn't expecting to hear our buddies at Racetime Radio, Tim Terry and the whole crew with all the photos and everything.
Yeah, it's cool. No, we have where we are now in this day of age of social media and stuff, you need to expose that stuff fairly well. So we had some help on it. Yeah, it looks great.
And sounds great.
Yes, that too.
So 2019 is all done. You had another solid top 10 in points, but I know you had some car troubles because your car went from black to white midway in the season. How can you sum up 2019?
I'm glad it's over. How's that? It's just one of those years that never ended. Started off pretty decent. We wrecked a race car at Halifax. That was a Port City car that we bought just basically 1 year racing on it. It was destroyed beyond economical repair. We dug out my old spare car in a week. Frenzy just basically built another race car in a week. Went to PEI. The rear end went in that. Fixed the rear end back up in the car. We ended up going to Petty. We damaged the rear clip a little bit at Petty. Anyway, in amongst all that, Trevor and Donnie were doing a little background bargaining, if you will, with Dylan Gosby over here, who had the third car sitting there. Anyway, we had a busy first half.
Yeah, it sounds like it. Sounds also expensive, too.
Yeah, very expensive. I mean, it wasn't for Donnie and Trevor and all the support that we get from sponsors and stuff, we wouldn't be able to do it, that's for sure.
It sounds like a few lowlights there, but what were some of the highlights with 2019?
I mean, we finished off pretty strong in Halifax. The car ran well at the IWK. We had some mechanical issues with it. The first race we raced with the Gosby car was in Antigonish. So we were heading to Antigonish with an unknown piece, actually. And we had some mechanical issues there that we probably would have sorted out on our own if we would have been racing the car through all summer, so to speak. So the car was running well there, just that we had some mechanical issues and had to succumb to a 15th or whatever place finish of that day.
So basically, you're going to be asking Santa for a brand new race car.
Maybe some pieces for ones that we already have.
Well, let's go back a few years, Kent, to share your story. You've been racing for nearly 30 years, but it's a family affair. Your father, Maritime Motorsports Hall of Fame member, Alan Vincent, used to race. When did he start, and when did you kind of start getting into that world as well?
Dad was racing before I was even around. He raced here in Freetown. He raced in Sleepy Hollow. And then two tracks kind of went away. There wasn't a whole lot of racing around. I forget the exact dates on it, but then Oyster Bed had started back up along with Clarence Foster's racetrack. Dunstaffinage anyway did. It raced the dirt track out here when it first opened up, and then I forget the exact years now, maybe 86 or 87, they actually paved the racetrack mid-year kind of thing, and went dirt to asphalt, and that's when I really started getting involved. And I was of the age to know what was going on and whatnot. And then in 1990, I started with starting the modified class down there with one of his old cars, a 1973 Dodge Charger with torsion bars and leaf springs, and we had fun trying to get it to go. But anyway, no, it was a blast.
What was Freetown Raceway like? Compare it to maybe Oyster Bed, if someone's only been to Oyster Bed before.
Fairly similar, a little bit shorter. Not quite the banking on it, but like it was dirt. There was actually a pond on the back stretch, and yes, there was a few cars that went in there. I think if I have the story correct, Donnie, they used to have powder puffs there. My mother drove a few races there. I think she may even have a few trophies at home on the shelf there. And I believe Donnie Lowther's wife, I think, might have ended over the guardrail, and they had the radiator dunked in the river there a little bit, but unfortunately, it didn't get hurt.
Wow. With the whole Prince Edward Island racing scene, I just want to ask this as well. One of the greatest Canadian racers of all time, Earl Ross, is from the island. He's the only Canadian to win a NASCAR Cup race. Was he a big influence over other fellow Islander drivers?
Oh, well, absolutely. Like, back in the day, you look for them heroes. You look for Richard Petty. You look for Cale Yarborough, David Pearson, then Earl Ross. I mean, that's when you were pushing the Dinky cars around, that's who you wanted to be, right? You wanted to be the stars. Kind of dating myself there, aren't I? Anyway.
did your father get to race alongside Earl?
No. Earl was off bigger and better things, but when Dad was racing then, yes.
So when you got your career started in the early 90s, the modified division, what was the competition like on the island? Because I'll be honest, I didn't know there was that many racetracks in PEI at one point.
There was when I started, I guess there's still probably two tracks going then, Dunstaffinage was dirt, and then Oyster Bed was still going. It was a pavement when I started, I believe. Competition was fantastic. There was, on every Saturday night, there was 25 to 28 to 30 cars there racing against my father, Alan McPhail, Kevin Smith, Rod O'Connor, Rod Taylor. I mean, them are the guys you went to beat that night, you know what I mean? Those were the guys that you looked up to and respected when you went out on the racetrack and whatnot. And anyway, it was good. It was a lot of fun.
You got off to a winning start. I mean, you won a few modified point championships in the 90s, and then towards the end of the decade is when you made the move to the Pro Stock Tour. But did you try your hand at NASCAR when they had dates at Oyster Bed before?
Not so much. I didn't really do the NASCAR stuff until 2000. The end of 99, our guys said we had enough. We wanted to try something else. We won the championship in 95, 97, 98, 99. So we thought we'd try to get on to bigger and better things. And at the time, Dad wasn't racing that much. So what we did was we kind of talked him into loaning his race car, his NASCAR to us. And we raced that first year under the NASCAR banner. And we won Rookie of the Year that year. I believe it went to the Maritime Pro Stock Tour the year after that, I believe.
So your father had some NASCAR experience.
Dad had the NASCAR experience, yeah. He raced in Sydney and Miramichi. He did all that stuff, yeah, before. I was busy at my own deal, so I didn't get a chance to go be around him at all. Like, we're both on two different tours, I guess you could say, and we didn't get too much of a chance to see each other race for a couple summers.
And there was no father-son wrecks or anything, right?
We might have touched bumpers way back in the Oyster Bed days a few times, but no, nothing like that.
This podcast is about Riverside, so now let's kind of tie it to Riverside. Did you go to Riverside as a fan first or a driver first?
I actually went as a driver first, and that would have been under the NASCAR banner. And I remember we were going, I think we might have been even, well, back then we were on the ferry, no matter what end of the island we went off of. But I remember talking to Dave Gorvat, just talking about the racetrack. I tried to put a bug in his ear to see if we can get some tips or whatnot. And he said, it's a lot faster than what you're used to racing on in Oyster Bed and stuff. And you're going to be lifting way earlier than what you need to be lifting. And No truer words were ever spoken. When you went to Antigonish, you were, it was a different experience than from PEI. A lot faster racetrack, and you could drive it in a lot. You had to drive it in a lot deeper and a lot farther.
Did you drive a little careful on your first couple of laps or your first hot laps there?
Absolutely. Probably more scared than careful.
Was that your very first high banked oval? Because I know Oyster Bed's got a little bit of bankage to it.
Yeah, Oyster Bed got a pretty good bank, but just as the long straightaways, Antigonish, you're carrying so much speed going into the corner, and you're just hoping it sticks when you get there.
What were some of those early races for you like at Riverside when you're racing with the best of the best, like Scott Fraser and Wayne Smith? I mean, you're door handle to door handle, probably three wide in some of those corners.
I was pretty cool. You learn a lot from them guys. You learn a lot from fellows like Wayne Smith and Dave Gorvet and John Fleming. Then Scotty pretty well. He spanked us pretty near everywhere we went there for the first few years that I was there. But yeah, you watch them. You race them guys with respect, and you get respected back. That's one thing I can say about all them guys.
Let's kind of skip ahead around. Did you get any wins or maybe even heat wins at Riverside before your two 250 wins?
We won actually a 100 lap feature there, I believe, before we won in 2010. I think it was maybe 07 or something like that. We actually won a 100 lapper there.
And you participated in the 250 races as well. Were those some of the longer races you kind of participated in? Because are there any 250 races on the island, or aside from the ones at Scotia Speed World or in New Brunswick?
Oh, yes, they were the longest ones. The 250s were the longest ones. We actually, you had to get yourself in a little bit of shape, a little bit better shape to do that. We were, back then, it was just 100 laps. That was the most we ever go. You might get the odd 125 or something like that. So the 250s were a big deal, yes.
What kind of prep would go into that? Like literal physical prep? Like you may drink a little extra water the day before or something, or mental?
Absolutely. I remember the first year where I used to actually is. I know a lot of the kids now are in pretty decent enough shape, but actually I started jogging a little bit in the mornings before I went to work just to prepare for that, actually.
So let's now go to 2010, the biggest win of your career at that point, your first IWK 250. But before really going into the win, you were racing against a current NASCAR Cup driver, Marcus Ambrose, and every year since the 250 has been back with the Parts of Trucks Pro Stock Tour and originally passed, there's always this celebrity driver. Does the pressure kind of increase when you have a current Cup driver alongside with you?
You always put the pressure on yourself. You always want to impress, right? These guys are where they are because they are good. Every one of the drivers that come here from away, obviously current past Cup champions and whatnot, they can wheel a race car. So you put some pressure on yourself to do better, yes.
What did it mean to win the biggest race in Eastern Canada in 2010?
It was cool. Like, we didn't have the fastest car by any means all day. We were up sniffing around top seven, top five, and then just circumstances came. We were in the right spot, the right time. I believe the year before that, I finished second to Wayne Smith, and I was on his bumper, might have been able to, move him out of the way, and he finished second to me, I believe, that year, and he could have did the same thing, and whether he couldn't get to me or just didn't do it, I'm not sure, but it was pretty cool.
So, with the 2015 IWK 250, before the race, the John W. Chisholm Memorial Cup was unveiled by the Chisholm family. Really a beautiful trophy that features the past winners of the 250 race. And you all received special silver plates presented before the race as well. And you were joined on stage by former 250 winners like Frank Fraser, Terry Clattenburg, Rolly McDonald, among many others. Did you really feel that you were part of an exclusive club at Riverside and the racing scene in the Maritimes?
Yeah, absolutely. To be on the same stage as all them guys that you mentioned and more is, it's an honor to stand there with them guys, that's for sure.
And with that race as well, it was a big battle with DJ Casey, and that's when you won your second 250 and that you were the first recipient of the John W. Chisholm Memorial Cup. How did that feel?
Beautiful. I mean, it was great to receive that and have my name on the trophy with all the rest of them guys was fantastic. Getting back to DJ, ran a clean race, and we ended up winning. That was great.
Was there a bit more pressure because that trophy was unveiled before the race?
Absolutely. You see that stuff, it's all part of the hype and the excitement of the race itself. Just something else you want to work for to get it and take it home.
And on top of that as well, with the Chisholm family, what did John Chisholm and the whole Chisholm family mean to you and your race team?
It means a lot. I remember we used to finish up the instead of finishing in Halifax the way we normally do, we have done the last few years, or the last race of the year for a couple of years ended up at Riverside. And John O'Donnell would invite us back to their shop. We'd have some beers and pizza and wander around the shop and tell some lies and have some laughs. I mean, it was big. Like, Donald and I started the same year. He's been a great friend along the way and a great competitor.
Was it harder to get the first win or the second win 5 years later?
Harder to get the second win. I mean, the competition now, the kids and stuff coming up, it's getting tougher and tougher every year. So the second one was definitely, and it was kind of the same boat. We didn't have the fastest car all day. Car was good and consistent. We were in the right spot at the right time when we needed to be.
It's kind of interesting what you say there about the younger kids. When did that kind of change? You had kind of the old guard there with Wayne Smith and some of the older drivers. I don't want to say older, but more experienced. And now we're getting to these younger kids, like guys my age, like Cole Butcher and Dylan Blankhorn, now even younger, like Austin McDonald.
Yeah, and like I said, these fellows are coming out of Bandos, coming out of Legend Cars, and they have more laps on them in January and February than we do come September, you know what I mean? And they're good. These kids can wheel a race car. They know what they want to feel in one. They can tell their crew chief, or they can adjust on it themselves for the most part to get the car to go. So it's the moving of the guard, I guess, or whatever, however you want to put that. Anyway, the new kids are coming in, for sure.
But you're the Iron Man of the Maritime Parts and Trucks Pro Stock Tour. You've completed every race since the inception of the series, correct?
Yes.
And you've been the most sportsman number of times, too. What keeps you level-headed and what keeps you going?
Just the love of the sport. I mean, I love it. The guys around me that helped me love it got backing from the family and everything like that. So it's just you're driven to do it, I guess, is for lack of a better phrase, I guess.
And you have just won back-to-back Fan Choice Awards at the banquet night recently for the Pro Stock Tour. And, you know, I see the effort your team puts in during the 250 weekend and every other weekend. You've got a walking potato around the track and all the cool stickers and everything. How important is it for you to be so interactive with the fans?
This day and age, you have to be. It's you have sponsors that, you know, it's they're watching where they're spending their money. So if you want to give them a good product. You want to be able to say, hey, this is what we can offer to you, and we try to do our best. We try to have some fun with it.
Keeping the island theme going, there's so many young drivers racing at Oyster Bed, and there's so many Islanders racing on the Pro Stock Tour. Who's a young up-and-comer from the island that you got to watch out for in years coming up here?
Jonathan Hicken had a standout year last year. Car was fantastic all year. Just if Blankhorn would have made a mistake, it would have been his. I mean, John's been around a long time, but still young to get it done, that's for sure. He had a great year. There's some of the other guys on the tour, or there's some guys in, Robbie McEwen, for example, who won the race here in the island. I mean, them guys are knocking on the door to be racing full-time and stuff, so he's another guy to watch.
Over the years racing at Riverside, who is the toughest opponent? Who is the driver, if you were maybe side-by-side, saying it's going to be a tough day to get around him?
You could name – that could be near anybody if they're leading the race with a few laps to go. But like I say, Wayne Smith was hard. Racy clean. John Fleming, an excellent guy, but you had to have a good car underneath him and go. And John Tucker, the same deal. Like, you had to have some good stuff to get by them guys.
Does being in the lead really, really matter at Riverside? It gets probably one of the most important things.
It's nice to be leading, yeah. And then you're kind of protecting your ground a little bit, and that depends who you're racing to. Some guys will you'll get the bumper from them and they'll drive off. But that just depends who it is, I guess.
You have two 250 wins in your books. Can you pick a favorite memory at Riverside? I know it's probably tough to choose since you're one of the only drivers to win two 250 races.
There's a lot of great memories from Riverside. Like just the first time to walking in the place ever, to the first time walking in to after the Chisholm's redone it. Like it's a beautiful spot. I get excited to go to it every every race we go to. It's the second to none facility around here. It's just a great spot to go anytime.
Did the racing change a lot when John got the track back and he completely renovated it, aside from changing really the dimensions?
The racing quality of racing was good. The racing chain, as far as the racing chains goes, Dylan, I guess it drew more people. It was, like you say, it was a state of the art spot, and it still is. From people coming to watch the race for us down in the pits, working on the cars to racing. At the end of the day, it's a great spot to go to race, that's for sure.
So we're looking forward to 2020. What's in the plans for you, Kent?
We got a few irons in the fire here now to try to figure out what to do with some race car. We got a couple cars here we want to work on here a little bit over the winter, and we'll have to make a choice on that soon, or we'll run out of time. So anyway, it's not quite sure what to do yet. We're still putting some sponsorship packages. I know Donnie Garnier's coming back from TireCanada.ca. He's back for sure, and we'll have to work on our other guys and see where we are with the budget.
So are you going to go back to a black car because maybe the white's a little bad luck?
I don't know which one was worse as far as the luck goes. It was just one of those years that we couldn't. You have years that you can't do anything wrong, and this was a year that we couldn't do anything right. So I'm not sure where we're going to go yet.
Who's the crew and who are the major sponsors who have helped you out throughout your entire long career?
We had many great sponsors over the last years. Like I say, this year with Donnie Garnier, TireTire.ca, and Hercules Tire, and we have Trevor Lamb's helped me out quite a bit as well. Summerside Chrysler Dodge came aboard the last couple of years. They leased me a truck, so to speak, for the summer to haul a trailer and stuff around. So that's priceless, that deal. ACT Hydraulics been helping me out now the last couple of years. They're a great deal. Of course, PEI Potatoes, they've been on board the last 3 or 4 years. They're fun to work with. Get Tate wandering around the back of the trailer there with us a little bit. No, it's cool. We have some great backing, that's for sure.
But we look forward to seeing the number 8, whether it's black or white, on track at Riverside coming up in 2020. And I appreciate you taking the time to chat about your career, Kent.
Thank you very much.
Here at Riverside, we support each other, and that also includes supporting our fellow drivers, and one of our own has made the finals in a North American contest. Owen Marr is a driver from Hubly, Nova Scotia. He drives karts, he drives Bandoleros, and Legend cars as well. He's a third-generation racer. He's the son of Daryl Marr and the grandson of Don Marr. Now, Owen has made the final 3 in a motorsports contest being held by U.S.-based Intech Trailers. Owen has made the finals of the Maxed Attack 4 through a series of elimination rounds, which started with 1,500 contestants, which was then narrowed down to 25, then to 10, and now it's the final 3. Owen is the first Canadian to even advance in the top 10, which is incredible. He is the only stock car racer in the finals as well. He's facing off against 2 female road racers from the U.S., and in each round, Owen has made a short video speaking about himself and why he should be the Intech's new brand ambassador. Results are determined by the number of votes each participant receives, and the grand prize of the grassroots racing contest is a new 24-foot Intech trailer valued at $22,000. Come on, everyone, let's support Owen here and help him out by winning the Intech trailer's Maxed Attack 4 contest. You can vote for him as much as 5 times by visiting the website www.intechtrailers.com/MaxTheTack. Now it's time to chat with our next guest on Victory Laps. He is a 3-time champion in the Pro Stock Tour, and he also opened up a new chapter at Riverside International Speedway with his first career win. My next guest is Sean Turpel. My next guest on Victory Laps is a 3-time Maritime Pro Stock Tour champion. It is a great honor to chat with this driver. Driver of the number 0 car, Sean Turpel. Sean, how are you?
I'm doing great. How are you?
Pretty good. 2019 is all in the books for this past season, the last full-time season for yourself. And going back to the final race at Scotia SpeedWorld, you didn't go out quiet. It was quite an exciting 200-lapper.
Yeah, it was kind of very exciting, close to the end. Started, I guess, mid-pack and worked our way up through to third at halfway, and then battled hard with the Butcher Boys, and, yeah, with about five to go or whatever it was, 10 laps to go there. We got tangled up with Jared and had to go to the back. So it was kind of a exciting but disappointing finish.
How was 2019 for yourself?
Not up to our expectations. We had a new car to start the year, and it just didn't pan out for us. We couldn't give it what it needed, and halfway through the year, we switched back to our old car, and got running great again, I guess. We never didn't win any races this year, but it was certainly nice to be able to, you know, contend and be in the top five once we switched back.
Well, let's focus on some good memories about your beginnings of your career, Sean. What got you into racing? What was the bug that really got you going?
My brother actually raced hobby stock cars. Just live in Enfield, so we're literally, you know, 3 minutes from Scotia Speed World. So he was 4 or 5 years older than me. He was racing when he was 16, and, you know, the whole family was basically involved in it and got the bug early and just pursued it from there. Got my own car when I was 16 and, you know, raced at Scotia for a while before we started moving up.
So what would the hobby stock division look like back then?
When I first got into it in 96, I think there was still an E, maybe an F feature then, certainly a D feature. So, you know, 60 to 80 cars per night in that class. Stangs, Ford Fairmont, Chevy Novas with the straight six engines in them.
So did you just kind of stick around Scotia with the hobby stocks, or was there kind of a way to branch out to the different tracks?
There was no branching out until, I think, 98, 99, when they had Moosehead Speedway in the Exhibition Park in Halifax, and they had the same class of cars there. I think they ran Friday night, so it wasn't the same night, so you could kind of go back and forth a little bit, and it wasn't too far of a haul for, you know, the old haulers, I guess we had at the time, for, you know, low-cost racing division, and that was about it.
So you mentioned you were a fan before. Did you make the trek up to Antigonish as a fan before you went there as a driver?
I did, yeah. I actually, going back to my brother, him and his friend helped Cy Harvey out on his NASCAR. I believe it was in 94. So we actually tagged along with those guys to a few shows, the 250 in Antigonish and Petty and some other shows. I think it was 94, the night the lights went out, and I remember being there helping Cy out and, you know, we set a chair up for him on the front straightaway when the power was out and stuff. And, yeah, was just always a big race fan.
What did you think of Riverside the first time stepping onto the grounds?
I don't really have any memories of the first time stepping onto the grounds besides going there with my sportsman car or the year before I started racing sportsman, going down there to watch Stacy Clemens or, you know, just a pro stock NASCAR race. And it was a cool facility at the time. Even racing there for the first time in my sportsman car, you know, it was a lot different track than Halifax or Moosehead with the banking. But not until they repaved it and redid the track did it, you know, really show its true character for me of just a beautiful facility and, you know, the speeds.
So let's kind of focus on that. So your first time racing in Riverside would have been in the sportsman car?
Yes.
And how did you have to adapt going from a pretty much flat Scotia Speed World to the high banked Riverside?
It was different. I mean, when we ran the sportsman car, we kind of ran the same setup everywhere, which wasn't ideal when we came to Antigonish, the high wedge and, you know, not really swapping any springs. It was our first year in the division. And I think we might have hit a podium one of the two or three races we went to that first year, but it was Bill Vassell and the Reed boys definitely put a spanking on us. The Warroad surface, like I say, it was just a different animal and our cars weren't set up ideally for it, but you could tell it'd be, you know, a faster track and a fun track to race on.
Was it really a night and day difference between the old track and when it was repaved a few years later?
Oh, absolutely. My rookie year in Pro Stock, 2005, you know, the Warroad surface with, you know, there was no crate motors then except for Rolly. Rolly had a crate motor that year. And big motor, Warroad surface, guardrail wall, it was an eye-opener. I struggled there first time there until they did repave it. It was just such a different animal racing against all those other guys with lots of laps on the road surface.
So what was the talk of the town or between the drivers when there's word that John Chisholm got the track back from the family that was owning at the time and that he planned to completely uplift it and renovate the facility?
You know, you first hear that and you hope it's true. And it turned out it was true, and then it was just the waiting game. You know, open test, I think, a couple weeks before the first race or maybe a week before, and the pavement was still very fresh. They had some lime on the track, and I remember going down for us to test, and, you know, seeing how we stacked up, and it was quite a different. It was like a brand new track. It, for me, only having raced there twice in a pro stock on the old surface, it was no comparison, and you know, the excitement of going there was second to none.
And you had big shoes to fill then too. You were tapped by the Fraser family to take over Scott's ride after his death in 2004. I mean, the pressure must have been crazy on your shoulders as a young driver.
Yeah, in a different way, though. It was more of, you know, the guys became my pit crew, basically, and they didn't put the pressure on me to live up to anything Scott had put down. They realized I was a rookie, second year, you know, in the division, second year by the time they had paved Antigonish. We had a pretty good rookie season, a bunch of top fives, a few podiums. And then went into that second year, and then with the Antigonish repave, and went there for the first time. And the biggest pressure actually was just on Frank and coaching me, trying to get more out of me at the track. He knew the car and myself had more in me, and he kept telling me to drive it harder and harder into the corner. And it's still a laughing point for us all these years later whenever we get together with a few of the guys, because Frank was so hard on me that weekend that I guess it panned out.
Yeah, so August 2006, a 200-lap race for the brand new, I'll say, Riverside. What was the festivities like leading up to it, and was there a lot of hype and glory with the reopening of the track?
Yes, there was. I mean, the place was absolutely packed. As far as how the opening ceremonies and stuff are today, I don't recall that being the case. I was probably just so immersed in trying to be faster as a driver and to get the car handling that the rest of that stuff honestly passed by. I was just so concerned with trying to get more speed out of the car. But certainly the bright lights, and you just had to look up, and I mean, the place was, you know, they were sitting on the grass. It was incredible.
And that was your very first pro stock win, not only a win at Riverside, but your very first win coming at Riverside. What did that mean to you?
Oh, it meant a lot to me, for sure. It's still my biggest win, but I think it meant even more to the team, for sure. It was quite a process for them to come from where they did to see their car go back to victory lane. You know, they worked so hard on it, and it was, you know, words can't quite describe for our team and our group what it meant for everybody.
And along with that, what did it mean to win the first race at the new Riverside?
Like I say, it's still my biggest win, probably my most favorite win. Yeah, I was just looking at the picture the other night on my shelf of my garage of me and Wayne and George were on the podium, you know, standing there with John, getting our trophies and having a laugh. And it was quite a night to remember. I still remember a lot of the race. I think something happened to Wayne early and he got down, and then battling with George on the final restart with, you know, 30 some laps to go, and Frank coming over the radio and, you know, telling me, you know, pumping me up verbally, telling me that's why they had me in the car, and coaching me, and to win it was, you know, you can't put words to it.
So after that win, you hitched up with Stevie Henderson to take over the familiar Zero car. How was your performance at Riverside over the years, right up until the very end?
Great, actually. 2007, I did the first race with Frank and them, and then Frank basically let me know, you know, we didn't know if financially we'd be able to do the whole season, and Stevie's ride opened up at the exact same time. And the first race I did with Stevie was at Riverside, and there was fireworks flying that night as well. We were, you know, fast right off the trailer, I think the fastest car all day in practice, and then trying to pass Wayne Smith for the lead very early in the feature, and we got together, you know, I blamed him, he blamed me, and I went around, smashed the car up a little bit. I think he came back to maybe win the race or be on the podium, and then there was fireworks, quote, on the front straightaway afterwards with my crew and his crew, and, you know, we won a few races after that. 2009, the year we won the championship, we won the second last race of the year, which would have been the final Riverside race to cement more or less lock up the championship, and then we won there last year, the first race of the year, I believe, by, you know, a thousandth of a second or something over Cole. Those are my three Riverside wins there. But I had a lot of good runs, finished runner-up in the 250 to Regan Smith the year he won it. You know, fireworks when I was going by him to try and run down Wayne Smith to second, and he stuffed me in the backstretch wall, and lots of memories, you know, some good, some bad, but it's always a place I love going to.
I just wanted to bring up that 2018 race, because that 2018 race was actually my first time at Riverside, and I remember sitting in turn four, four and that massive pileup happens on the start. You clearly avoided it. Where were you in that situation?
Yeah, I started on the pole, actually. I started on the pole. Cole was outside in the outside pole, and I still had the big motor in for that race and shifted up out of the corner, and he had the crate motor, and there was no chance he was going to hang with me. And then I don't know what happened after that, if he missed a shift or just didn't go, and it wrecked the whole, you know, three quarters of the field. From there on, we just battled back and forth, me and him were front, and so close there at the finish, back and forth with rubbing hard, and quite a finish, quite a memorable one.
Did you know that you won at the time when you both crossed the start finish line, or do you kind of wait for the crew to start freaking out?
I had to wait for the word from the tower. I mean, I knew I was going back by him, but I just didn't know if I was by him. By the time we get to the start finish line on the outside, he got a good run down into the corner, and then just roll on the top, more momentum, and like say we got a big run out of four and just got back by him. I guess by the time the transponders crossed the line, it was so close.
So over the years of racing, you raced at the old Riverside and the new Riverside. Who would you say was your toughest competitor on the track? Who was the driver that if you lined up next to him, you knew you're gonna have yourself a tough day racing?
I would say for as many races I did there, Wayne Smith and Donald Chisholm. We struggled there a few years up until 2018 with trying to get the right car set up, and Donald and Dylan and them would be so far ahead of us. But years previous to that, you went there and you raced hard with Donald, and like I say, Wayne Smith was always good there. One of my other memorable races there would be the second IWK 250. I think it was a pass race, the second pass race there. Mm-hmm. First time they went there was in the fall, and then the next year when it was actually the July weekend, we were racing hard with Mike Rowe for the lead of the race. That was 2007 when I was racing with Stevie. And being there on American Racers and good shocks and four-barrel carburetors, I think some of us got down in the 13-second bracket in practice and time trials, and it was just so fast. And guys were blowing tires because the tires couldn't handle the speed of the track, basically. And that's what happened to us. We were trying to get by Mike Rowe for the lead, and had a tire go down and wrote the car off. But just a lot of good memories. And, you always have to race so hard there. You can't cruise at all. You have to give it everything 100%.
Just to kind of go back to what you were saying about the pass there, was there a huge difference between the Pro Stock Tour and pass between the cars?
Chassis construction, no, very similar, but just when you bolt the Penske shocks on, the adjustable shocks, and their tires were the biggest difference. Like 3 or 4 tenths at every track just in the tire speed, as well as put the four-barrel carburetor on with the open motors that pretty much everybody was running then. There wasn't any crate motors, certainly in pass. You know, you're looking at 600 horsepower open motors with the softest tires you'd want to have and good adjustable shocks. As a driver, you couldn't ask for anything more than that. You were flying, like say sub 14 second laps, so fast, but the car was so underneath you with that much tire grip. It was a lot of fun.
That's crazy.
Yeah, it was.
So a lot of good memories at Riverside, and before the Atlantic Oliver Tire 200, you announced that you're stepping away from full-time competition. I don't want to be the newsbreaker, but what does 2020 look for Sean Turpel? What does it look like for Sean Turpel?
Looks like I'll be doing some camping, and see what the family wants to do. We'll probably, the IWK is still on our list for somewhere that we're going to camp for sure in July. And we'll see where the rest of the year takes us from there. We've been, looking at some other campgrounds that we have never been to before, or we haven't gotten to yet in the province or in New Brunswick. And just taking a step back and spend more time with the family.
So you're trading in the steering wheel for the car for the steering wheel for the RV.
Yeah, it's just a tow behind, so it's just my truck. I get lots of miles in that in the summer anyways, and we do camp at most of the racetracks we go to. It's great to hang out with our fellow racers, the Hickens, the Butchers, Craig Swan White. It is like a big family, at the track and away from the track with quite a few of my competitors anyways. I seem to not have too many enemies, and our families hang out together and makes for a great weekend. So looking forward to do a little bit more of that.
But it's a never say never. You're not officially retired. You're just kind of taking a break.
I don't know. No, I did say I was retired, but I'll stick with that for now. Yeah.
Well, whatever you do, whether you're in the stands at the IWK 250 or any other races, thank you for entertaining all the race fans here in the Maritimes. Who do you want to thank, and who are your main supporters over your long career that you'd like to thank here?
Everywhere. My mom and dad for getting me into racing. My father-in-law, Jim Ledwidge, for, you know, helping me buy my first sportsman car and being a sponsor since then on all my pro stock cars. Certainly the Fraser family for putting me in a pro stock and giving me that chance. Stevie Henderson, Cecil Vance for letting me drive and work on their top-notch equipment. Always great to see George and Donald, Kevin McLean, Paul McLean, the whole group at Riverside Speedway. They always make you feel like you're at home or do whatever they can to make your stay and your visit more enjoyable. You know, just so many people, all the great fans. I was lucky enough, you know, to get a lot of Scott's fans kind of tagged on to me, and they're incredible. Just all the fans, you know, racing fans are so passionate in this area. Even if they're maybe booing for you on certain nights, you still got to, you know, be proud to be from the Maritimes, and all the enthusiastic fans. It's been great.
Well, you'll be one of the fans in the stands booing or cheering now.
Hopefully cheering. I try not to boo too many people unless it's kind of joking, you know, ribbing a guy a little bit. But look forward to watching a few races. We usually took in the Friday night sportsman show on the 250 weekend anyways from the grandstand side. So I guess this year 250 night will be in the grandstands as well looking on.
Thanks for sharing some memories about your career, Sean.
Yeah, thanks for the time.
A huge thanks to Sean and Ken for sharing their stories. I wish all the best to Sean and, of course, all the best to Ken. He's got to get ready for the 2020 season. Get your calendars ready and mark down July 16th through the 18th because that's the IWK 250 Super Race weekend. We just made the announcement recently, and things are going to kick off on Thursday, July 16th with the Test and Tune and Tailgate Party. Friday, July 17th, we're going to have the Napa Sportsman Series and at least one other series to entertain you, and then on Saturday, July 18th, it's the IWK 250 presented by Steve Lewis. And drivers, well, they're getting ready, and word's going around about the 250, not just in the Maritimes. I've been seeing J.R. Fitzpatrick posting about returning to the 250 as well. And just in time for the holidays, you can purchase a special discounted Christmas package right now. This includes a pair of weekend general admission passes as well as a classic Riverside t-shirt and cap, and it's available until December 10th. IWK 250 camping renewals and reservations will be available online in January, and we will have more event details. They'll be available in the near future. Of course, you can keep tabs on what's going on at Riverside on Facebook and Twitter, Riverside International Speedway. That's where we post all the content for our Throwback Thursday celebrations, and of course, on our website, riversidespeedway.ca. The checkered flag is waving. I'm Dylan Angel, and thank you for listening to Victory Laps, part of the Throwback Thursday celebrations for the 50th anniversary of Riverside International Speedway.